welcome to another episode of the Competitive Intelligence Podcast. In this podcast, we're going to talk about something that's known as the ERRC grid, not maybe the best acronym, but it actually comes from a book that I'm sure some people are familiar with called Blue Ocean Strategy, even if they're not quite as familiar with the ERRC grid and maybe a little more with the strategy canvas, which is something else we'll probably return to at some point in this podcast. But before we get into that, a couple brief programming notes. If you want to look at the archive of past podcasts, go to our webpage, cascadeinsights.com/resources. You can see all of the past podcasts. We're also available on iTunes and Stitcher Radio and a few other places, but our site also has transcripts available that you can pull down. We tend to keep those up to date within 2 or 3 weeks of the latest podcast. And with that, let's get on to the show. So the interesting thing about Blue Ocean Strategy first, right, is, hey, you know, you got to love guys that pick a great title, you know, at a minimum when you think about it. They basically pick a title that probably guarantees them sales regardless of what's inside the cover, right? Now, the other interesting thing about the Blue Ocean Strategy guys, though, is they get a lot of talk for certain frameworks that they cover in the book. And one of the ones that I think is really, really critical when you think about market intelligence and competitive intelligence work is the ERRC grid. The ERRC grid basically says, what are the things that this industry might eliminate, raise, reduce, or create in the author's sense to basically going and unlocking a new blue ocean, right? So I'm not so much worried about their evocative power here, but the idea that this is a meaningful framework to essentially, you know, put an industry or a set of competitors through to say, what might be coming? You know, you use frameworks like scenario planning to see the future. Well, this is another way to do that in a way. You're looking at a current state of an industry and saying, well, what are the things that people might eliminate in terms of things the industry's longer competed upon, things they might raise well above the industry standard, things they might reduce, things they might create. And one of the really interesting things is that the authors of Blue Ocean Strategy said that you drive companies to fill in the grid with the actions of eliminating and reducing, meaning reducing things that are below the industry's typical standard, as well as raising things above, and as well as essentially, you know, creating and eliminating. So, this is a very interesting thing because I think a lot of companies, when they look at competitive and market issues, they almost always look at it from the perspective of, well, we're going to eliminate and reduce, or we're going to raise and create, and that's our market position, right? And what's cool about this is it actually makes you think through all of the areas to give you kind of a stronger position. So it's a pretty fascinating little framework.
Yeah, and I think anytime you're dealing with strategy, you know, companies, they always want to be all things to all people. They want to believe that they're relevant to every segment. They want to believe that they're relevant to every customer. And so they don't intentionally choose to not do certain things. They don't intentionally choose to write off certain parts of the market to do orders of magnitude better with other parts of the market. And any kind of framework that forces you to talk about what you're not going to do or what you're going to do, you know, quote unquote, poorly as a decision is important. And it's relatively rare in a lot of business thinking.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, you know, there's a lot of, you know, the act of using the scissors is not exactly something that comes naturally to capabilities, right? It comes naturally to costs. It doesn't always come naturally to capabilities, though. I mean, it's very hard to have grown a capability and then consciously decide that you need to actually eliminate it. That's a challenging thing to do.
It's also important to have a balanced team. Some people will be the growers. You know, some people are just wired to kind of always be widening, right? Always looking for new opportunities, new ways to do things. So they're always growing new shoots, which is great. You have to do that. Otherwise, you're just going to stay exactly where you are. And other people are wired to be the pruners. You know, their disposition is just to go whack things that just haven't panned out. It's important to have a team, a leadership team, a management team that has a mix of both kinds of people.
Yeah, I would agree. And so if you walk through one of these in like a simple case, right? let's take a look at, you know, I don't know. Let's take a look at something like, you know, your typical smartphone, right? So, you know, or actually let's look at wearable tech, right? That's a good example, right? If we move into kind of that space, right? What are the things that a really successful wearable tech manufacturer, you know, if they were to use this grid, is going to have to think through? Well, eliminate. What factors that the industry has long competed on should be eliminated? So what are some things like a wearable tech manufacturer might have to eliminate as part of their kind of product design, their business model, those kinds of things?
Right, right. So you get to things like it's not going to have a screen, or it's not going to have a screen that's anywhere near what a phone or tablet screen is. It's not necessarily going to have a keyboard as an input device. You know, there's lots of restraints because of the form factor that are just going to force you to rethink this device. I mean, you're just going to have to eliminate certain, you know, kind of input output.
You've got one there in terms of reduce too, right? I mean, any display on a wearable tech device will technically, you know, from a technical standpoint, it will be reduced below what the industry typically thinks of as a computing device display. And this makes sense. It happened with smartphones, right? The display on a smartphone wasn't as good as the one on your monitor or on your notebook. And, you know, you see the same thing happen over and over and again. And, you know, in this case, it's not necessary to have maybe the same display. So that's going to be a place where you're going to have a change. And then you also have things you're going to have to create. They're going to have to create an ecosystem of people who can plug into that particular type of computing model, because the applications that are required, the type of mobile application, sure, some of them maybe will port over from the previous platform. That happens all the time in computing. But it's also likely that there's going to be completely new application architectures that will obviously just snap right into wearable tech. And those are going to need, you know, new investment, new opportunities, new partner programs. That's all creating people who will essentially be there. And you see Google with Google Glass, they're doing this right now. I mean, they're, you know, on one hand, you could say that they didn't give all the glasses to everybody because they simply refused to, you know, generate enough production, or they didn't want to invest in that. I think it's a little smarter than that. Honestly, they just wanted to give it to people who are typical inventors who like to create. They didn't want to give it to the people who were going to critique it all day long, because it's not really ready. It's not really ready for that. It's not a prime time device yet.
Right, exactly. No, and then you think about RAIDs, right? In wearable computing, power efficiency is going to have to be raised. You're going to be dealing with a much smaller battery. You know, the telemetry that the device collects, I mean, you know, if you think about Fitbit and a lot of this sort of stuff, every step you take, every time your heart beats, you know, the calories you're burning, all of this kind of stuff you may want to track. Location, they may need a really good compass. You think about glasses, and if you want a heads-up display for what you're looking at, it may have to be very accurate in the direction you're facing, you know, more so than other devices. So there's all kinds of things that are being raised. But thinking through this, okay, what are we throwing out, and what are we putting on steroids? I think you can see just from this exercise in a couple of minutes of how beneficial it is to just think in those terms.
Right, exactly. And that's all we're trying to say, right, to our listeners, right, is that, you know, these frameworks, like we've talked about before, and then we'll have to wrap here in a second, these frameworks, they provide that intellectual hack, right? They make your brain work more efficiently and more effectively, because they usually force you to process through either two things you don't normally do in tandem, eliminate and raise, or they just simply make you think through a variety of possibilities that are usually hard to do in somewhat of a linear progressional fashion. And that's what make them great. And, you know, what really at the end of the day matters is how creative you can be in your application of the framework and how rigorous you can be at the same time, which, again, is another one of those interesting dualities, creative and rigor. With that, I think we should let folks get back to work. And thanks for listening again, and we hope to see you on the next podcast.